discuss what those are.
Thank you, Chair. Keith will be dealing with some of the items here, so I'll sort of just stick to the couple that touch on my sort of role. My understanding is that we hope to have the legislation out that deals with these additional items during the course of this week, which will still allow people some time to comment. Hopefully today, but certainly by tomorrow. Now, let me start with what's on slide 88, page 44, which is domestic PBOs conducting fundraising for foreign causes. Yeah. This is something that was announced in the budget review and which we have done by way of regulation already. Essentially, what it says is that a South African PBO that is engaged in gathering funds to send offshore to another PBO that is very similar to the kind of PBO that would be tax exempt in South Africa, and which is in fact tax exempt in its home jurisdiction, will qualify for exemption in South Africa. So it can gather those funds and send them overseas for poverty relief, education perhaps, something of that nature. Now, as I said, that's been released by way of regulation at the moment, but you will recall that Section 30 of the Act says that where the Minister does this by way of regulation, it needs to be brought into the legislation within a year, and this is part of that process. So what we're doing here is we're proposing to amend the 9th schedule so that a public benefit organisation that is engaged in collecting funds for passing on to foreign public benefit organisations that meet certain criteria will be able to qualify for tax exempt status. This one is likely to be a proposal that draws a fair amount of comment, and the idea here is that we have a number of payments that fall due on the 31st of March, which also happens to be the day that the government's fiscal year closes. And what we've encountered in past years is a problem where certain bank transfers or bank deposits are not reflected in the SARS account on the 31st. And sort of around 11 o'clock at night, we are phoning bank CEOs to find out what happened to the money that was supposed to arrive between this period and that period, to try and ensure that we get everything in that is due by the 31st into the SARS bank account, because we run on a cash basis of accounting, which most businesses do not, and which we will not in years to come. But we run on a cash basis at the moment, and this creates a significant problem in ensuring that all the funds that should be in the SARS bank account are in the SARS bank account. So the proposal here is to permit the Minister of Finance to bring forward payments that are due on the 31st of March by a maximum of 2 business days. So if, say, the 31st of March was a Wednesday, the Minister would be empowered to say that payments are due by the Monday, the 29th of March. And that would give enough time for any missing payments to be tracked down, and we could then ensure that everything is in that should be in. The idea is also here that there would obviously be a reasonable period of notice, because this is not something you'd want to do on the 14th of March. This is probably something you'd want to do in January already, so that people would have an opportunity to A, become aware of this, and B, plan the cash flows appropriately. And then just on the next one, at the moment the Income Tax Act provides that SARS can assist another tax authority in the collection of that tax authority's debt, provided we've got a DTA between the two jurisdictions. That's been in the Act for many, many years. So many years, in fact, that it no longer complies with the OECD model. And the primary respect in which it no longer complies is that if the person denies that there's a tax liability, we have to bring the president of the tax court into the picture. And if you have a look at the current OECD model, it essentially says that you should never involve your judicial or administrative authorities in determining whether a debt is valid or not. So we have a clear conflict there. So what we're proposing here is twofold. One is we tidy up the provision so that it talks about all taxes as the model does these days, and just clear up some technical issues that exist in it. But primarily that we take the president of the tax court out of the picture as far as this is concerned. And instead what we will do is the test as to whether we will collect the debt on behalf of the other tax authority is there a real dispute here? In other words, the person can say, no, I don't owe this money. We would then check with the other tax authority, has a formal dispute been opened? If so, we would not collect unless, and those are the last two bullets, this dispute is a frivolous one, which is merely intended to stop collection, or there's a risk that the time that the dispute is running will be used to essentially conceal assets or get rid of it. Unless those two circumstances are in place, if there is a dispute in the home country, we will not collect. If there is no dispute in the home country, we will collect the funds and we will pass it on to the home country. So it's essentially just there to ensure that our underpinning framework in our legislation matches the current international basis for collecting taxes on behalf of another jurisdiction. Keith, I'll hand it back to you for the other two issues.
Thank you.
The two issues are, one is retirement and the other one is on an unbundling issue. This retirement issue, just we had to work out some details and that's what held this one back. There's a number of very difficult combinations that happen, but when you have a retirement, and we're talking here about a pension fund, when somebody dies, what happens to that pension fund? Now that money can roll over to beneficiaries in an annuity form. It can, or it sometimes can be pulled out. Now, if the money is pulled out immediately, the old law will continue to apply. And what happens is, again, let me just break this down in a simple way. The way the system currently works is if you pull the money out, you're taxed. If it's rolled over and it stays in annuity form, no tax happens until there's a subsequent cash out in the form of annuity. What we're really dealing with this proposal is sometimes the money comes out of the system temporarily and then is put back in the system. Now, when it comes out temporarily and is put back under current law, you're taxed as if you just pulled it out. So once you pulled it out, you might as well pull it out and not put it back in. Essentially, what the rules we're doing here is saying is you take the money out temporarily and then back invest in a beneficiary fund, we're going to treat it as if it was exempt all along and it never came out. That's essentially what we're trying to do. And I don't think we should go further on that. The other one now is on corporate reorganizations. Now, unbundlings. An unbundling is basically a division of companies. So parent owns all the shares of subsidiary, and what happens is the parent company surrenders the shares of subsidiary. In effect, an unbundling is a reverse of a merger acquisition. You're breaking companies apart to make them more efficient. An unbundling is one of the more generous tax provisions because it's not just a rollover regime, it's actually a tax-free regime. You get complete exemption from a dividend tax and a capital gains tax. But the general rule is designed so that at least the parties who end up holding the shares distributed should be taxable persons. So at least the assets remain within the tax system. However, we have a rule that says if the distribution is to exempt parties and those parties own 20% or more of the shares distributed, that unbundling rules will not apply because we want to make sure that the ultimate shareholders remain within the tax system. there are some, we have, based on further evidence, we're adjusting the 20% test. The 20% test isn't going to focus just on the shares distributed, it's going to look at the subsidiary as a total. Because if the company as a total is held by taxable persons, then we should be fine. We're not going to just focus on the shares distributed. And that's the change that we have there.
Okay, that's it. I'm now going to open it up for a discussion, comments, questions. But just a more general comment. At the beginning of your briefing, you set out the time frames or the times for public comment, when you indicated that taxpayers had 1 month to have 1 month to comment on the bill, published on the 31st of July. Comments are due and up until the 29th August, / 5 September. And we're having our hearings from tomorrow, which hopefully we'll finish them tomorrow again. And you indicated that you would respond on the 9th of September and envisage tabling on the 16th of September. But looking at that, also you have these five additional items that you have spoken to, which now fall outside of that consultation process. I'm not too sure how we're going to handle that, but we will discuss this at the end of this engagement. But I would want you to, you know, provide me with an answer that takes us forward on the issue of public participation on this legislation. Members, questions, comments, Dr. George, Mr. Molodo, Mr. Mbuoni, Mr. Maria, Mr. Singh. Okay. Dr. George.
Thank you, Chair. On the retirement reforms, with a specific reference to taxation on withdrawal before retirement, I mean, at the moment when member leaves employment, they can take a tax-neutral transfer to a retirement annuity, a preservation fund, or to another fund. And preservation funds permit a once-off withdrawal prior to retirement. I've looked through your explanatory memorandum and you don't make any mention there with preservation funds. I'm just wondering whether the new tax regime on this might well influence people to make a withdrawal from preservation funds. There's a lot of money in preservation funds at the moment. Then on the adjustments to the dates of payments to SARS, I do understand the problem, and in the memorandum there isn't much explanation on it. But have you considered any other solution to this problem? Because it seems as if there is a problem with SARS getting the money on time or being able to account for it on time, but then making the problem the customer's problem. So, you know, what is there no other solution to this? And then finally, on the venture capital companies, I think that there is significant risk in venture capital, and obviously that these companies would need to be regulated very carefully. But have you considered, for example, incentivizing people who invest on companies that are listed on the Altex, on the JSE, for example, because that would maybe get to the same solution? Thanks, Chair.
Okay. Mr. Mlock.
Thank you, Chair. My first question would be on industrial policy projects. I just want to establish from National Treasury and SARS, in one of our discussions with you, we did query the issue of the old strategic industrial program, and the answer that you gave at that stage was that a lot of jobs were not created because of capital depending. Now, how are you going to address that issue, and how are you going to ensure that the same does not apply? My second question, Chair, is on executive share schemes. Your proposal of including various directives, And the explanation that you are giving here, it's not clear to me, because you give, for example, cash amounts determined in reference to share values held in trust, but it does not clearly define to me how these derivatives are being utilized for avoiding tax, because as stated here, I can't find the link between derivatives and this cash amounts. Can you explain that further? Chair, I think that should be all.
Mr. Mboni?
Just short on share. On the 10% exemptions to housing subsidy or employers providing housing to especially farm workers. What happens in the case where a farmer decides to sell the farm or he just expelled one of the employees on the farm, whereas the employee has already bought presented property and you've already given the 10% incentives. And in the case of employees having shareholders, those employees who are not so hardworking, you take the shares back, or the company decide to take the shares back, and you've already given an incentive to the company, then how do you work it out in that case? Yeah, those are the 22 ones here.
Mr. Murray?
Thank you, Chair. It is quite a comprehensive piece of legislation, so it's absolutely impossible to ask all the questions today. And it will probably be, I think best to wait for some of the hearings, and I think from that will flow a lot of questions, or will be dealt at that stage already. Just my first question on the electricity levy. We know that there is to a certain extent a contentious issue because of the economy and how people are suffering that. In other words, must one see that as a penalty stroke disincentive to the community, or is it something that will be used to the benefit of the communities? And if it is going to be used as a benefit to communities, how do you foresee this to be ring-fenced and to make sure that that is applied correctly in that sense as well? In other words, that is not just another form of a revenue for Eskom to play around with. Then, Mr. Chair, to Cecil, my usual subject, and that's about the disability expenses. I've looked at the draft, and the draft is obviously not saying anything at all about all those expenses. The one thing that is very important and has always been contentious is medical related expenses. What do we mean by medical related expenses? And I can use a simple example. A person with a disability, well, first of all, I will touch on the definition as well. A person with a disability that has got a leg that is dragging on is going to be heavy on shoes. But anyone is wearing shoes, so you can argue that is not an expense, a medical related expense. But the fact that that person uses 3, 4, 5 pairs per year is directly related to not to the medical issue but to the disability. So in other words, there's certain expenses that is directly related to the disability of that person or the dependent, and not necessarily to a medical in terms of a sickness or a medicine that they use. So one must be very open about that. Another simple example is someone with a physical disability that walks along a wall. So they will probably go through a jersey or a top very quickly, just like that. Now that is not a medical related expense, but it's an expense directly related to the disability of that person. And it's an expense that a person under normal condition will not have. So one must be open to that as well. Just on the definition, and I've seen in the draft that you try to align that with what is what government is saying, or cabinet is saying, but one must remember that there's always a saying, don't an able-bodied person must never assume for a disabled what is acceptable. Now, a person with a disability will always tell you that they're not disabled. In other words, they can think for themselves, many of them. They can do a hell of a lot. So they are incredibly able. So they are persons with disabilities. And that's a huge difference. And that is human dignity, all those things that is underpinned by the Constitution and the human rights. Yeah, that is very important to look at that. Thank you, sir.
Mr. Singh.
Thank you, Chair. Just want to check on the issue of housing, where you've got low-cost housing and figures of 200,000 and 250,000. I mean, that definition or that bracket, is it SARS brackets, or is it in terms of Department of Housing? Because there they talk about affordable housing and middle-income housing and things like that, social housing, and my colleagues just come in to help me. Yeah, good. And then also on the biodiversity, the one that Cecil told us about. I mean, you refer here to agreements and things like that, and you talk about DEET. I mean, is DEET and or provincial departments geared up to enter into these kinds of agreements, which would then be used for these tax exemptions with yourselves? And then my last question is on the estate duty and life insurance. From what date will this be applicable? You know, the not adding life insurance policies and pensions into your estate. Thanks.
Okay.
Slide 62.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair.
Sorry. Did you miss something?
Yeah, I just forgot one minor one. In case where the on dividend tax, so if it is a company for subsidiaries, it pays dividends within the company itself, there's no tax liability there. What are the possibilities of tax evasion that issue?
Okay, let's take responses.
Thank you, Chair. Well, I think we'll certainly get everyone to come in, but can I just say, needless to say, we welcome the comments, and I think, for example, I think given the complexity of the bill, I think the comments that come from members and from the public, I think, are very important. And I think that on some of these issues, it would be very good to hear comments even on the fundamental policy. So, for example, the question related to withdrawals. I mean, the one issue is, should we even allow withdrawals? It was something that we looked at in the Treasury, but it would be useful to see what comments we ultimately get for those before we get then to what extent, if we allow it, should we be generalists in what we allow, and so on. Just on issues like, I think, let me thank Mr. Maria just on the comments on persons with disabilities and just the way we word it. Certainly, we're trying to move that way, so to the extent that there are specific comments like those, I think we'd certainly take them on board. So clearly, you know, we're not a species, we should be moving away from handicap. I think just on some of the other issues, let me deal with the responses I wanted to, that I'll deal with directly. I think on the electricity tax, ultimately, it is driven by the fact that we do need to reduce our carbon emissions. And all users need to factor that in, and you want to cost in that into the price. That is the most effective way to ensure that we reduce demand. And you know, whilst it's and I've dealt with the mega users, but you know, even in our homes, there's no doubt that most of us tend to use electricity like there's no tomorrow. You leave the lights on, you have lots more heaters running, whatever. And really, the idea is that you make people more conscious of the price, they'll use less, and you hope, therefore, even have a lower electricity bill if they are more efficient in the use of electricity. That's the hope. The intention, like with the plastic bag levy, is not to generate revenue here, although it will generate revenue, and we'd be quite happy to generate less revenue just because usage has gone down. It ultimately just goes into general revenue. So that's the rationale behind the electricity tax. And the idea is that ultimately all users should be paying for that. It's not money that goes to ESCOM, because it's the generators who are paying for the tax, and they will presumably pass that on to other people who buy electricity from it. But perhaps, I mean, just to respond, why don't we just go systematically? I think, I don't know if there were any other, Dr. George raised two issues. Do you want to deal with it, Cecily?
Sure, I'll give a statement, a few ones, and then Keith. On the VCC one, I think one must not lose sight of what we're trying to achieve here. And people want to try and achieve hundreds of 10 things with the same instrument, and we can't. Can't do job creation and things like that. It's an equity gap, and to the extent that most of the entrepreneurs that start off businesses are unlisted businesses, the intention is to help those guys. So once you have grown big enough and you become listed, you've already bridged that gap. So we don't think there is a good argument to continue an incentive. The exception that we have is in the case of mining, especially small mining. We do allow for mining companies that are listed on Altex to still benefit from this, because there the risk seems to be much higher. But to incentivize other companies that has reached and grow to the point that they are listed, we think they should be able to access capital through that mechanism. So we don't think there's a strong case to continue that. Mr. Lotto, I'll try to deal with your question on industrial policy projects. I think we probably missed the boat in trying to identify what we want to achieve with these objectives. I think to think that we will be able to, on these mega projects, have significantly direct jobs was probably ill-informed. I think our objectives with this new incentive is slightly different. Here the issue is to upgrade the technology being used. The objective is to promote better energy efficiency, cleaner technologies, and skills development. Those are the key issues. We have job as a factor, but a very small factor here. We don't think these particular projects in itself will be job creation. They will facilitate better growth. And therefore, we've moved away from a noble objective to create jobs where we think we missed the boat. So we hope that explained that. On the housing, it's a difficult question in terms of farmers and things like that. I think the objective here is twofold. One is to provide an incentive for employers to provide housing in two respects. One is rental accommodation, which in the case of farmers is probably mostly the case. And the other case is where the employer can actually buy them. So whether the employer has bought the property, there's no issue that it becomes the employee's house. But where the rental arrangement is still in place, one would presume that the new farmer would still use the houses for rental, because if he doesn't, then there's a problem. So unless you evict the farmers, the workers, and use the houses for something different, there you'll have to probably have a clawback, because then it doesn't use the house for what it is intended. And I think we'll have to make sure if we don't have a clawback facility there, it should be there. Okay.
Answer the 200, 250,000.
Yeah. Yeah. No, your mic. You're causing problems.
On the housing side, we've grappled with this one. Because the because we provide an incentive, and because the problem is at the lower end of the market, you know, you have to have a cut point. We looked at the most recent census, and we've talked to the Department of Housing specialists within the Treasury, which is in public finance, and we have been given an indication, it's housing up to the value of 2,000 rand would probably qualify as low-cost affordable housing. So it's a cut of 200,000, sorry. It's a cut-off point we worked out. It's not a SARS issue. We've looked at all available information, and we also had an indirect discussion with the banking council the other day, and it seems to me that 200,000 currently is a reasonable cut-off point. It's probably on the higher side, but I think it's a number which we can stick with for the next 2-3 years, which is quite reasonable. And bear in mind, we're also excluding land. So even if you include the land, you actually talk about a slightly higher value. So yeah, it is something, and we'd like to have comments on it. I don't think there's case to increase the amount at this stage. But if people want to increase it, they'll have to have a good argument. All the information we have, it should not be increased. Just the last two I would like to deal with. One is the disability. Mr. Murray, I fully agree with you. We've tried to consult with this. We had a couple of organizations in that help us to fine-tune our thinking, and we're still fine-tuning our thinking. The idea of the list is exactly to answer your question. It's the challenge would be for us to develop a list of expenses that are reasonable, and that we update that list on a regular basis. And we'll pass that over to SARS to do on an annual basis, but we'll work closely with SARS on that. But it's exactly to overcome the problem that you've raised, that some of these expenses are not strictly in terms of the technical definition medical, but otherwise. And so once we've got a reasonable list, which we will do in consultation with the various organizations, SARS will have something to work from. Currently, the law doesn't provide that flexibility. And then lastly, from my side, on biodiversity, Mr. Singh, we have been in discussion with the Department of Environmental Affairs and Tourism. We have been in discussion with the Biodiversity Agency. They informed us that yes, DEET and the provincial authorities will have the capacity to engage in these agreements, and some of these agreements are already in place. So we have taken their word for it that they are capable, and in some provinces they are more advanced than other provinces. So we've worked on that premises, and the incentive will only kick in once that agreement has been signed. Thanks.
In terms of just on that, I mean, there was a list of all the agreements they've entered into, but there's actually a fairly lengthy list of agreements. And I think the minister's signature is all that's needed, but a lot of the details haven't worked out. It's quite significant. Just some quick things. Dr. George raised this point on preservation funds. There was some concern. Basically, one of the confusions is that when we talk pension fund, we mean pension, provident, preservation, blah, 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 blah. So the withdrawal, pre-retirement withdrawal, covers the preservation fund as well. The old regime, and you're only allowed to have a one-off withdrawal from preservation under the old law and under the new law. That isn't changing. The old law, though, allowed you a timing benefit because you based your current rule based on the last 2 years. So you could time it. The new rule, it doesn't matter. You just do it and that's it. It's a standalone thing, and then you add up the old one. So I think the new regime isn't going to create any additional worries or, you know, concerns about further leakage. I don't think that will happen in this. Another question was raised, I think it was Mr. Maloto raised this, about the derivatives. I kind of skipped over. Let me just tell you what the deal was, okay? So the executive share schemes. If your employer set up a fund, and in that trust were shares for the benefit of an employee, the anti-dilution avoidance rules applied. However, instead of putting the shares in trust, they still kept the shares in trust, but they said to the employee, instead of getting the shares, you will get a value equal to the shares, but you're not entitled to the shares themselves. By doing that legal mechanism, they defeated our anti-avoidance rule because they never actually got the shares. And that was basically an amount derived from the shares. I'm saying it's an amount derived from the shares that saves the shares. So that's essentially the deal that they were doing. And a few others that are a little more complicated. But that's the essential one. Just to add on to the point is there are recoupment rules on housing. So if the deal is cut short and the employee has to pay upfront cash, then there's a recoupment. but I'm not sure if we fully dealt with job changes. There are some rules, though, around, you also raised, around employee share schemes. What do you do if they become lazy? Again, the tax system does think about that. If they are lazy to begin with, you don't have to give them the employee share. That's number one. Two, if they become lazy and you want to get rid of them because of that, or because they do misconduct, if you gave them the shares at 100 value, you can take back the shares at 100 value. Because presumably they got the shares for a reason initially. But they lose the growth if they're not, if they don't fulfill their end of the contract. So that's basically what happens there. Let me see if the other ones that were raised. Another one just pops out to mind is the question of the estate duty. When does it kick in? Obviously somebody's doing a little estate planning, they're worried. The new rules, let's just say, are 1 January 2009. So if you plan to die, do it after that. You look kind of healthy there, but you know, if you want to plan your way into that kind of thing, we'll give you that freedom. Then the only other one was raised was, Mr. Nguni raised company to company. If there's an exemption on company to company dividends, do we have anti-avoidance worries? We do, and that's why the personal holding company regime is there. What we're afraid of is an individual will never collect the dividends directly. They'll set up a company to collect dividends because that company will always get the exemption. And if you set up a company designed to take advantage of that exemption, the personal holding company rules, passive holding company rules will kick in and apply the 10% immediately. And I think those are the
ones. Which I believe leaves one for me, which is moving the payment date forward. Have we explored other options? Yes. I mean, over the last few years, we've done things like create engagements with our major taxpayers who make payments on the 31st of March so that we keep track of what they're going to be paying, when they're paying it, to try and manage where the funds are. We've obviously worked very closely with the major banks to ensure that we have real-time information on what kinds of deposits are flowing. And in fact, that's some of the nerve-wracking stuff, is when that real-time information suddenly stops and there you sit. And you say, okay, I don't believe that this major bank suddenly stopped accepting deposits. What happened? And that's the nerve-wracking thing. But I certainly hear the concern that we are shifting the issue to the taxpayer. That is really... But it's a very difficult one, because the whole question of whether we've met our target or not is something that has macroeconomic sort of spin-offs and so on that people look at internationally as to what's our deficit, how do things fit together. So... It's not an easy choice to make to propose this, but we have tried other mechanisms to deal with it. They're not quite getting us there, so we are proposing this, and obviously we look forward to the comments we get back on how people perceive it.
I think just on that one, I think one must also understand that in many cases these payments are payments that has been sort of 30 months, 30 days, or sometimes longer after the fact that money has been collected. So it's not that you're going to squeeze taxpayers in terms of money they haven't got. It's just a question of a lot of, like for example, VAT. VAT was collected and it's only payable 30 days later. So I think although it will, in the circumstances, change the current rules, it's not, the burden is not any significant cash flow that you deny the taxpayer. It doesn't have it in some cases.
Okay, thanks. We are still going to be having hearings, and we'll proceed with the deliberations. But on the general questions I asked earlier, I would also want us to hold back until we have taken the hearings to hear how it impacts on some of the stakeholders. If it affects them, in the interest of the participatory democracy, I would imagine we would have to allow space for such to happen. That's about it. But also on presumptive turnover tax, you made mention of on the basic rules. You spoke of those restrictions at the bottom there. The question is, what if the turnover exceeds the VAT threshold during the 3 years? Because you said you get in, you're stuck there for 3 years. You opt out, you are out for 3 years. So what if you exceed the VAT threshold within the 3 years, which means you fall into another category already? Are you stuck for 3 years even then?
Great question, Chair. It's one that was asked by someone else. It's maybe something I need to expand on a little. The way it works is that if you are pushed out of the system because you have exceeded the million, then you come out. So, and in fact, that is the one, normally what happens, to simplify the issue, is if you voluntarily wish to move in or out of the system, you would do that in a 2-month window period to, at the beginning of a tax year. Okay, so that we can deal with a whole tax year at once. We don't have sort of broken periods. But where your turnover has exceeded the million, you can come off the system halfway through a year. Now, that is quite a significant step, and we wouldn't want to invoke it for someone who's exceeded it by, you know, 1,000 rand or 2,000 rand. So if you look at the draft legislation, what it does say is if you can satisfy the commissioner that the excess is of a nominal and temporary nature, you can remain on the system. So, you know, if somebody sits there on the 26th of February and has hit a million and they know they're going to receive another 5,000 rand over the next couple of days, they don't necessarily have to be kicked off the system. On the other hand, if somebody is halfway through the year and they are sitting at a million and they've got a contract for 3 million on its way, well, that's not temporary and nominal, so they need to come off the system and into the main system. I think that's the distinction that needs to be drawn.
Okay, and also the one last simple one. The issue of donations to multilateral humanitarian organizations. How and who actually detects or determines if funds have not been used for humanitarian purposes?
Chair, there is an annual return required from all public benefit organisations in which they would provide a copy of their financial statements, and we could then review that to see what the funds have been expended for and determine whether in fact they have met all the criteria that are set out in Section 30 and their constitutions. So generically, that is something we do for all PBOs. We have a separate PBO division that does nothing but approve public benefit organisations and review their tax returns. And essentially, these institutions would slot in to that system.
Okay, thank you. That then brings us to the end of the session on revenue laws amendment bills. Thank you. And we're only halfway through. Thank you very much. We then move on to our next item on the agenda, the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Royalty Bill. As members would recall that we had not formally considered this bill, but we had promised. Now is the opportunity for us to do that. Members, are there any questions on the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Royalty Bill? If none, I read the report. So first, the motion of desirability. Okay, I read the report on the royalty bill. A report of the Portfolio Committee on Finance on Minerals and Resources Royalty Bill 59 of 2008, National Assembly, Section 77, dated 19 August 2008. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Royalty Bill 59 of 2008, National Assembly, Section 77, referred to it and classified by the joint checking mechanism as a money bill, reports that it has agreed to the bill. No, that's the second one, the administration one. We're coming to that. It's 59. And then Bill 60. You are in a hurry to get it. These two bills will be debated on Thursday, members, and we've requested that they be debated as one bill because the other one is only just the administration bill and the other one the money bill. The motion of desirability on the administration one, Bill 60, 2008, that in the opinion of the committee, legislation is desirable to provide for the administration of matters in connection with the imposition of a royalty on the transfer of mineral resources and for matters connected therewith. Agreed? Agreed to. And the report on the administration bill. The Portfolio Committee on Finance, having considered and examined the Minerals and Petroleum Resources Administration Bill 60 of 2008, National Assembly Section 75 Bill, referred to it and classified by the joint tagging mechanism as a Section 75 Bill, reports the bill without amendments. Agreed? Agreed. Thank you. Thank you. That then brings us to the next item on the agenda. Yes. We have circulated a copy of the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Bill. In the remaining few minutes, as we had agreed, and members might be aware that on their notices, this meeting sits from 9 o'clock, as Dr. George noted this morning, until 7:00, 1900. For the sole purpose of dealing with this legislation. And members told me when we walked in this morning that they're very excited about this long meeting, and we're looking forward to it. But I must say that I think it was an error, and we apologize for that. Bradley was over-optimistic. He wanted us to stay here. We're staying until 1 o'clock because there is a sitting. So we are going to ask Advocate Jenkins where he's here. I just saw him walking in, and where did he go to? We just want him to quickly walk us through the areas that he has dealt with, and we would then take a decision as to when and how we are going to proceed. We have scheduled a meeting for Friday where we are going to deal with outstanding matters, but for now we would like Advocate Jenkins to quickly walk us through those areas that have already been addressed in the bill as directed by the committee. Advocate Jenkins, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Honourable Chair, members.
You need time to open your bag.
No, it's can't close, Honourable Chair.
Oh, you can't close.
Too much. The bill before you, before the committee, is a few amendments in the interest of time. If I heard you correctly, we want to finish by 1 o'clock, if I understand you correctly. On the chair.
It depends.
And now I can
go ahead.
Keep you busy. What I've tried to do is to include all the discussions of the 12th and the 13th of this committee in the bill now, and to actually have a more rounded off product. I don't think the bill is perfect yet by any means, but I think we're moving in the right direction. What I have done, which is more than textual, I would say, more than just trying to get the right wording, the legal language there, is what I will present to the committee, and one can go into the details further if there is such a requirement. I also have raised, marked a few areas where I think the committee must take another look at the bill. And those are also not exhaustive, but just as I was going through it and redrafting it, I tried to indicate it. What I've done first is in the fiscal responsibility clause, that's clause 4. In my opinion, it wasn't quite clear whether what was expected of Parliament in terms of Clause 4. You know, the Fiscal Responsibility Clause used to ask something in line with Parliament and its committees must ensure that there's an appropriate balance and so on. And now I'm not 100% sure what that means. So what I'm suggesting here is that one rather say that Parliament and its committees must still ensure that after the amendment or decision that they take in terms of this legislation, those indicators in Clause 4 must be present. If one reads the previous course, for if I can make myself a bit clearer on that, it implies it, but it doesn't actually get to the point where one actually says, after you've made your amendments, taking your amendments into account, your appropriate balance between revenue and expenditure and borrowing must be, there must be an appropriate balance, and the debt levels and debt interest costs are reasonable, etc., etc. So I just try to bring that up. So that would now sort of set out the parameters, the railway track of this train to run upon. An issue that I would like to highlight, clause 4, sub 2c, it says that in fulfilling its obligations in terms of this section, Parliament and its committees must take into account all public revenue and expenditure, including extra budgetary funds and contingent liabilities. Now, all public revenues includes my rates and taxes and so on. I'm not sure whether Parliament wants to take all of that into consideration when fulfilling its obligations. In other words, when proposing amendments to a revenue bill or appropriation bill or something like that. I think one must just sit down with a glass of water and think through that. I think it's too broad. I think it goes beyond this bill.
We'll just flag it. Some of the issues we would have to discuss, because we should also not reduce fiscal responsibility to nothing. Yeah. At the end of the day,
Honourable Chair, if I can just say on that point, that's not the intention of my comments. Yeah. The intention would be to say, can we actually implement this bill? Can we make an amendment where we feel it's necessary, given the oversight functions, etc. On the issue of parliamentary committees. I've tried to bring out the powers in clause sub 2 and 5 sub 2. I've tried to bring it out more to say that these committees has all the powers and functions conferred to it by the constitution, legislation, the standing rules, and then including considering and reporting on those matters listed there. Of course, further on in that section 1 or that clause, one do require, or the bill requires, that the standing rules provide further functions and so on and so on. But it's just to reword it, to bring it more in line with what's written in the joint rules, written in the standing rules of Parliament about these committees. It's not the same wording, but it's more in line with it. Now, what I would bring under the attention of the committee in clause 6, the one that was discussed last week on the document prepared by Alter Falscher, and I am handicapped here today by not having you here, not just the committee. There we looked, and the issue was other committees of the National Assembly must assess the performance of each national department. Now, I was sitting with that glass of water thinking about this, and I thought, I'm not sure whether it's the committee that assess the performance of a department. Firstly, I think the committee makes those recommendations, but in the end it would be the House that makes the final determination. And assess fits into the idea of performance assessment, I understand that, but to ask Parliament to assess it, one might find the view of saying, well, what is it exactly that we must do? We are used to considering annual reports and commenting on them, but if we must assess, we need key performance indicators. And we have certain indicators there. I just thought, in line with the normal wording, let's say the National Assembly, and that's another thing, we're not having any role for the NCOP in this clause 6. The National Assembly must annually consider the performance of each national department with reference to the following. And then it sets out the indicators there. In my opinion, it doesn't change much of the meaning and the intention of that phrase, because what we're working towards is to get to the what clause 2 calls a budgetary review and recommendation report. Now, that was what the committee said. We need to not have a statement of intent, we just need to have a report explaining that we, as Parliament, find this lacking or that is not lacking, that is good or commendable, and so on and so on. So I've changed that wording, and maybe for the benefit of the committee, I'm not here to change the intention of the committee, but I'm just trying trying to bring it more in line with the normal language we use when we're talking about the reports of the houses and of committees. As I said, there's no role for the NCOP to play here. That needs to be flagged and looked at, maybe, Honourable Chair. Clause 2.
Okay, perhaps let's make sure that members have understood exactly what it is that your change implies of the wording with regards to those the annual reports. You said it's clause 6.1. Said the National Assembly must annually consider the performance of each national department and public entity with reference to the following. And originally we had said the Assembly must assess the performance.
But originally, the document we discussed Wednesday last week, Honourable Chair, verbatim it read, oversight committees of the National Assembly must annually assess the performance of each national department. And then we said, no, that must be other committees. And therefore, I'm thinking maybe this is a function, not maybe, this is a function of the House. The House obviously delegates or asks the committee to come up with a report, but in the end it would be the House that actually considers and...
Okay, understood. I think it's not because the further committees do that as an extension of the House. Already mentioned, it's not... Any comments? Mr. Marais and Ms. Fobson.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that if we do that, it doesn't restrict the committees in terms of, you know, a proper oversight. Because this is should be part of oversight to make sure that, you know, that is, you know, in I think in terms of the intention of assessment. In other words, we want to assess whether there's a prudent policy, a principle, and whether they've applied that, whether they're spinning that in the right priorities. So in other words, if this doesn't restrict us in that sense, yes, then one can most certainly look at it, because I can see what you mean and try to convey to us in terms of assess. You know, then you have to go and set out your rules of assessment. But if it's consideration, then obviously you can basically broaden your own list of how you want to consider that. So as long as A to G will not restrict you or limit you in terms of what you want to do, really want to do.
Ms. Pops?
Thank you, Chairperson. Certainly, I would concur to a large degree what my colleague on my physical left has said. And I wouldn't really have a problem, because when you consider something, and I do agree the idea of the National Assembly includes all the committees, so I'm not tackling that particular issue. But on the term consider, in your consideration, you would do several things. Among them would be the assessment to a degree. Included would be deliberations. Included would be analysis, etc. So, in fact, it is a far broader concept and acceptable, I think, Chair.
Okay, Mr. Mullard. Mr. Mullard.
Thank you, Chair.
No, the other Mr. Mulotto.
I'll
come to you. Then I'll take Mr. Swart and then Ms. Mokot.
Thank you. I thought you wanted to give Mr. Black a chance first. Chair, the way it's worded here, it just seems to me that it places the onus on the National Assembly, which is not a problem, but it takes away the authorities of the portfolio committees. And I'm just worried that the wording may be, you know, shouldn't it be that the portfolio committees will consider the national departments and with reference to the following, and report to the National Assembly for a final decision or something of that nature. I'm just asking whether it doesn't sort of cut out the portfolio committees at this stage in terms of this wording as it stands now.
Okay, perhaps let's agree on this, because my understanding was that Advocate Jenkins is saying is that when portfolio committees conduct their oversight, they do that as an extension of the House. They actually are the national. We are the National Assembly as we see it in the NAA as portfolio committees and in the NCOP as you are Parliament. But let's make sure that we are one on this, because it is precisely at the heart of the change. It starts there. Because originally we were saying that portfolio committees, now we're saying the National Assembly. But how does the National Assembly do this? It does it through the portfolio committees. That's my understanding. Before I take Advocate Jenkins, Ms. Mokoto was on, and then I will take care.
No, I think I'm covered. But just to say that we must maintain consistency. Because here we only talk about the National Assembly, whereas I think each house has to do the same function. Thank you.
Mr.
Chair, I agree with the fact that we must have consistency, and I think in the rest of the bill we talk about committees. So maybe one must just qualify that and say that the National Assembly via the relevant, or through the relevant portfolio committee, that we identify that. So in other words, it's not a new structure that the National Assembly must set up to do that consideration. And I think we must probably be more explicit in that regard to it, just to have the in line with other intentions of the bill as well, or expressions.
Advocate Jenkins.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. No, I think it can work to say the National Assembly, through its relevant committees, must annually consider the performance of each department and public entity. And the issue of the NCOP, I find it personally a gap here, if I can call it that. I think the NCOP does play a role in making some statements or making recommendations based on the issue of annual reports and so on. Certain departments function that way. Department of Health, for instance, functions through grants to provinces, and the Department of Health nationally is but the shell. I think in infrastructure wise, so that I think is an important thing. There's something else I would like an opportunity just to address the committee on, but afterwards we've dealt with this. Thanks.
I would want us to flag it and deal with it more because we are also going to go back on some of the things that we have discussed now. I think that's what we're beginning to do. We were very explicit that this is the role, where this role actually belongs, and whose mandate it is also. So I think we're going to drift back now and begin to repeat some of the stuff we've already discussed and concluded. I saw Mr. Swart's hand was up, and then Mr. Mulodo, and I would want us to close this one if we can't reach any conclusion by flagging it and apply our minds.
Okay, now just the definition of National Assembly in here says includes the NCOP. The definition in this bill, if you read it, it says it's National Assembly.
Yeah, no, the House. The House could include the NCOP, or the Parliament could include the NCOP, but the National Assembly and the NCOP make up what is called Parliament. Those are the two houses. The other one is called
House.
The National Assembly.
Yeah, the House, yeah.
Yeah, okay. No, fine. Mr. Mulodo and then Ms. Hobbs.
Let's flag the other issues for Friday, because I'm not sure even on the issue of NCOP, because I don't know whether they consider annual reports. As far as I know, they don't. So that's why I'm saying let's flag that for a debate and we can revisit it. But I think,
look, Ms. Pops, because then what I would want us to recommend here is that Advocate Jenkins just walks us through some of these areas, and for members to go and read this document, so that when we return on Friday, we have read the document, and we've also listened to some of the, you know, reasoning behind some of the changes that. And I would also want to recommend that in future, perhaps Advocate Jenkins, you must desist from implementing some of the changes having advanced them with the committee. You know, let's start here and then we structure to put them on. Because if you put them on already and you want to convince us that you think you are correct, we'll encounter the situation that you're encountering and reach a stage where as the committee will just be stubborn and say, no, you just write what the committee has said. And, you know, in order to avoid that, let's first discuss it in the committee, and then by the time you put pen to paper, we already have agreed on some of these things. Okay, do you want to proceed, and then at the end we would note those areas that we have flagged, and then Friday when we meet, we would have had an opportunity to read the document also. Go through.
No, fine, thank you, Honourable Chair. Another issue in Clause 6, I mean, the initial draft we discussed last week refers to national departments, but of course Parliament's oversight functions go beyond national departments, go also into public entities and then constitutional institutions. I've included public entity. I've not included constitutional institution because that's a more difficult one. Personally, from a legal point of view, I don't see a problem looking at the strategic objectives, the annual report of a constitutional institution, and then making a finding on its effectiveness. I think Parliament does that in any case. But the constitution requires that these institutions are independent and are supported. So one must just maybe give it a thought. But from my side, legally, I don't see a problem with including constitutional institutions and public entities throughout this bill. When it comes to these oversight reports, Parliament must consider. Honourable Chair, I'd like to draw the committee's attention to sub clause 1E referred specifically to Standing Committee on Public Accounts, which should be the Committee on Public Accounts. I thought one must throw it wider to include all committee reports, but I've noted what the Chair has said about that modus operandi of mine, and I just want to draw the attention there. It is there. I mean, I'm guilty as charged on that one. So that's there.
Yeah, I know he's also mumbling it. He's not saying it loud enough.
I'm at six, clause 6,
yes.
Sub clause 1E.
Right.
It's on page 6 at the top.
Okay.
1E used to read the Standing Committee on Public Accounts reports on a department. Now, that in any case is not a proper formulation, because the Standing Committee on Public should be the Committee on Public Accounts, and they report on the Auditor General's report and related matters.
Okay.
And I thought when one refers to reports adopted, that's a consequential amendment. I also want to look through the bill on that. I mean, if one say we can use a committee report, what does that mean? Does it mean we can use a committee report before the House has adopted it? Those committee reports one will find in the ATC, but that's prior to the House adopting them. So one must just think, legally I would say one can use that report only once it's adopted by the House. So then on a broader perspective, this bill will actually create some additional gears for Parliament, because a lot of reports languish below the line for a while. But this bill will require that these reports are considered adopted before other processes can kick into operation. Clause 7, Honourable Chair, the medium-term budget policy statement. I've basically just included and changed some of the wording of Alta Falsher as discussed last week without making substantial amendments. I would just like to indicate an issue. Clause 7, sub 2, F, that's on page 7. It sets out there what the medium-term budget policy statement must include, and it refers to at number F or the numeral F, a review of actual spending by each national department and each provincial government between 1 April and 30 September of the current fiscal year. I was thinking whether that shouldn't be current financial year, because I think provinces and national departments have the same financial year. Local government have a different financial year. Local government has a different financial year. But when we look at the actual spending, we can refer to the financial year, fiscal year. There stands to be advised by the committee. Yeah, I would say either current on the three you chair. I would say it's the financial year under review. Yeah.
Okay, yeah, you'll see. I have a bit of a difficulty here, you know my problem. Yeah. I've got a lot of Zulu words that would actually enhance the when it comes to English, please assist. Okay. Yeah, yeah. When this bill is interpreted, I think one of the official languages it must be interpreted into. It's going to be Zulu. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Clause 8, one, I would just raise an issue at Clause 8. One, it requires the Minister to table the national annual budget in the National Assembly as required in terms of the Public Finance Management Act at the same time as the Appropriation Bill and the Revenue Bills. Now, I think that happens at this point in time. So the question I wanted to raise is, what if this is not possible? Should the minister then explain why it's not possible in this specific year, or should we just, I mean, if it doesn't happen, that it's not possible, then one can leave it like that. But this bill is actually dealing with a procedure. Usually one would, like the PFMA deals with procedures, you have to submit their annual report at this time, and it must include these things. But the PFMA always has this, it has a sort of an exit clause. If you're not able to label it in time, then one must explain. So this is the issue to flag.
Then you must bear in mind, we're talking here about the tabling of the budget. You can't be having the ifs when it comes to that. Yeah. I don't think. Yeah.
I would agree.
I don't think that's the route we want to go.
Yeah. Next section, or clause 9, adopting the fiscal framework on page 9. Honourable Chair, I've made a change there. The discussion we had last week referred to clause 7, 9 sub 7. It says the Houses may consider reports referred to in subsection 6 for adoption within 16 days after the tabling of the national budget. I thought that must have been a mistake. I thought that should be must. The Houses must consider reports, because we're trying to set out the procedure, and I think that was just an oversight. Clause 8 and 9 is the procedure that was discussed last week that should be similar to the Section 75 procedure when there are differences between the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces vis-à-vis the adoption of that fiscal framework. So I've just tried to set that out. If members could look at that. I've captured the meaning there. Honourable Chair, Clause 10, passing of the Division of Revenue Bill. I've looked at the sub-clause 5 there. The standing rules must provide for participation of chairpersons of other committees, public hearings by the committees, and then it said any member of Cabinet affected by the amendments to respond to the proposed amendments, and the same with affected provinces and local governments to respond to proposed amendments. Honourable Chair, my feeling is that this word effective sets sort of a admissibility criteria there. One will ask a member of Cabinet or a province, but are you really affected by this amendment? And I thought, if one sets time frames like this bill does, one can, through the leader of government business or through your NCOP structures, invite comments from any member of the cabinet, any province, within a certain time frame. It's not really going to change the way parliament operates. Having the word affected there, one always wants to ask then the member of cabinet, but are you really affected? Do you have a right in terms of this legislation to make that submission? And I was trying to get around that. So I would like to...
Once again, advocate, you say, I don't know what is always in this glass of water that you take when you take some of these decisions. Because I find it very difficult to deal with such matters now at a committee level, because if you say you found, I mean, let's have a discussion before you put your thoughts down, because you know it then becomes difficult. Now, what is it that we're discussing? Because you already have put this down, and you then motivate when you already have put it down. And when we say take the stuff that we have discussed here and put it in the bill and bring it back to us, we want to see what we have, you know, instructed you to write into the bill. But if you feel that some of these things, as you were putting them down in with your glass of water, you felt that no, this is, it doesn't make legal sense, or you know, it's inconsistent with the normal or with the, you know, normal practice, flag it and come back to us and say, but you know, when I was trying to implement what you had instructed me to put down, it just didn't gel. And I would imagine the committee would be quite happy to discuss this. But as it is now, at times it dilutes the actual sense of what the committee had intended to do when we, you know, it was instructed to do some of this thing. You say here, any member of cabinet, and the committee had said any member of cabinet affected by this the amendments, any province that will be affected. You know, going to be discussing this thing all over again, but it came from the committee in, you know, with the intention of actually making sure that the affected parties actually have given an opportunity. Ms. Fox?
Yes, Chairperson, certainly one concurs with the process you outlined. Let's get the information and then discuss it on Friday. But, you know, I'm just a little alarmed. I realise I haven't missed one day. You know, it was Wednesday and then it's now again today. But there seem to be so much of this is underlined in this copy, which would indicate it's new, if I understand correctly. And that is a highly significant amount of changes, number of changes. Really, it's massive. It's like 90% of the bill that I last looked at. So I'm not objecting to your process. Perhaps I'm just making a comment, Chair.
No, I see the underlining, some of the stuff that's underlined here was underlined in the previous one. And I see the dots then, I think then they explain what is in the boxes on your right. I think that the dotted lines seek to deal with matters that are in the boxes on your right. Advocate Jenkins.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Now, on that one, it's as you say, Honourable Chair. Everything might be underlined, but what happens is that we have a document prepared by Otto Fulcher, and I'm cutting that and pasting it in the version of the bill before the committee to bring that in. So everything remains underlined, and then to make things more complicated, when one then deals with those wordings from the document of Otto Fulcher, the computer doesn't pick those changes up, because that's an amendment to an amendment. Mm-hmm. So that's why I have to indicate those. For instance, the issue of affected, I mean, the clause used to read, must allow any member of cabinet affected by proposed amendments on the conditional grants, and allow for provinces and local governments affected by the amendments to respond to the amendments. So, but Chair, I've thank you very much for the direction on that. What I'll do is, in the future, I'll compile a document with these suggestions.
Let me just recommend something here. Let me recall the document that you have circulated. All together. You go back. you sit with Alta, you check on the issues that you had originally set in the committee you deal with. And members, please don't keep this document. I do not want this confusion to continue beyond today. You sit with Alta, you satisfy yourself that everything that the committee had said you must take on board has been taken on board. Committee on Friday, and begin looking at those areas, and also begin to open the issues that we had parked earlier. And I think it's highly likely that we are going to do what we had originally said we would do, that we'll have to take one day from our constituency to come back here and spend the whole day. Dr. George, this time it will be from 9:30 to 1900,
yeah,
because we will have to utilize that day to the fullest and finalize this bill once and for all. So let's do that and not proceed with the confusion. Anyway, thanks, members, and Advocate Jenkins. Yeah. And I'll ask Bradley to make sure that all the copies. We are going to count the copies we had circulated, because we don't want these copies to find themselves in the public domain, and they are not the committee's documents yet. Okay, that brings us to the end of the session, and it's about 1 o'clock. The lunch is set. I invite all of you. Thank you.